Hello, and welcome to Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. We're coming to you from the studios of KALW in San Francisco.
Continuing conversations that began at Philosopher's Corner on the Stanford campus.
Today, the morality of food.
The morality of food. Come on, Ken. Food? I mean, we're the program that questions everything, but do we have to question food? I mean, people are going to think, the philosophy of food? Food is food. We eat it. We need it. End of story.
Au contraire, John. The topic of food is fraught with philosophical implications. What people eat says a lot about their approach to life, their conception of the place of humans in the cosmos, and their basic values.
Well, tell me more.
Well, let's start with where you get your food. Most people don't grow very much of their own food, so you go to the supermarket. But which supermarket? You can go to a market like Whole Foods or some other such store where you can get organic, chemical-free food and eggs from supposedly free-range chickens. Or you can go to Safeway with lower prices, to be sure, but more chemicals and eggs from chicken raised in small cages. Your choice of supermarket says a lot about you.
Well, I can get into this, I guess. I mean, you go to a restaurant, you order beef, which tastes good, but implicates you in the effects of steer flatulence on global warming, wanton use of hormones, stinky feedlots, and other inhumane practices. Do you order veal, which implicates you in animal torture? Do you order beef? Or do you avoid beef and order fish? But which fish? Salmon from the sea, which is overfished? Salmon from farms, which pollute? Catfish from sustainable farms, where the catfish are typically harvested by electrifying a whole pond and gathering the electrocuted carcasses with a rake?
And there's more, John. There's even more. I mean, do you eat food to enjoy it, or is food for you just a bundle of nutrients? Is eating good food an intrinsic value, an end in itself, or just a means to an end, you know, staying alive?
You know, Ken, it sounds like by the end of this program, I'm going to be a vegetarian or, God forbid, a vegan.
Well, even that's not so simple, John. I mean, most of the species we eat have co-evolved with us and are dependent on us. Is it better for chickens to raise them humanely, kill them painlessly, and eat them, or release them to the mercy of coyotes and watch the species die out? And do you consider just the lives of currently existing chickens? Or do you care about all the potential chickens that will have no life at all if you go vegan?
Ken, I'm getting depressed. We're supposed to question everything, but I kind of wish we'd taken a pass on food.
Well, John, luckily, we won't be left to our own devices on this one. Our guest, Michael Pollan, author of The Omnivore's Dilemma and In Defense of Food, he's an expert on this stuff. He's thought about the topic of food inside and out and seems to have come up with a philosophy that allows him both to enjoy food and at the same time to feel good about himself.
Can you guarantee me he's not going to tell me I need to subsist on carrots and lettuce for the rest of my life?
Well, let's wait and see what he says. I'm not going to anticipate that. But here's the structure of our show. We'll start by getting a sense of how food habits have changed over the years, especially recent years.
Then we're going to move on to see how the way we eat reflects our obligations to animals, the environment, and other people.
And finally, we'll press Michael Pollan for his suggestions about how we can eat healthfully, ethically, and also enjoyably.
First, our roving philosophical reporter, Julie Napolin, follows the latest food fad. She files this report.
In 2007, the new Oxford American Dictionary announced their word of the year, locavore, someone who only eats food grown within a 100-mile radius.
Here we have our tomato plants. We're growing 5 different kinds of tomatoes.
Margot True walks through the urban garden behind her office at Sunset Magazine.
And here are what I think is the best cherry tomato on the planet, Sun Gold. Here, taste one. It actually fell off. It's so ripe.
This editor believes fresh, local products are a more nutritious and socially responsible way to eat. So she decided to take the locavore movement to the next level.
Some of us were wandering around the campus one day, and I noticed that we had figs growing, and we had a kumquat tree, a grapefruit tree. We had all this food already here, just various and sundry, and I thought, God, why don't we just cut to the chase and do a one-block diet?
Instead of eating food grown within a 100-mile radius, True designed a one-block feast, where all the food comes from an area the size of a small backyard. Though they raise their own honeybees and egg-laying chickens, the staff hit certain limits, especially when it came to the wine.
We didn't realize that we would have to get 600 pounds of grapes. So that was another one of our imports. We went to a local vineyard, a winery, and we picked 600 pounds of Syrah, and we brought it back to Sunset, and we stomped it with our feet in the parking lot.
Editors became beekeepers, fact checkers became chicken farmers. Everyone had a job making the feast happen.
We've really started to feel a little bit like an old-fashioned village, all sort of coming together to produce something. And it's been just humbling to realize that none of this is new.
To me, there's no doubt that the whole connection to your food, the more that you're involved with the food earlier on, the more deeply satisfying it is to eat it.
Molly Watson writes on local food and designed many of the recipes for the One Block Feast. Watson says local food, grown by yourself or from a farmer's market, encourages people to cook for themselves.
Food tastes better when it's made with a lot of good intention. And when you cook, you do put something of yourself into the food. There's something I think that people crave in homemade food, and I do think it is that there's a level of intentionality in its preparation that comes across.
When we were eating it, we just felt the pleasure of it. We literally felt virtuous. You know, it wasn't an abstract. It was palpable, actually.
Sunset Magazine's Margot True says the feeling of eating food you've made from scratch can change your sense of self.
The kinds of work that we've been doing associated with this One Block Feast project, all of it is real. Gardening is real. Sitting down to eat with other people is real, and especially when it's food that you've grown. It's just quiet and slow, and so much of it is unspoken, too, in this super verbal culture that we have. It's so lovely to feel something larger that you might not even want to articulate.
For Molly Watson, the main motivation for eating local food, whether from the grocery store or from your backyard, is that the food tastes better. Social responsibility is just icing on the cake.
If you get people acting that way, and they're eating really what the best tasting stuff is, so often that ends up being the more socially responsible, the more environmentally responsible, the more politically responsible. And that's what's going to get people's attention and keep them motivated and keep them eating that way, is that the food in the first place is really delicious.
For Philosophy Talk, I'm Julie Napolin.
And I'm Ken Taylor. And
I'm John Perry. Today we're joined by Michael Pollan, professor of journalism at the University of California, Berkeley, author of The Omnivore's Dilemma and In Defense of Food. Michael, welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Thank you, John.
Good to be here.
So, Michael, how did you become so interested in what might be called the ethical and intellectual side of food? I mean, most of us like to eat it, but most of us don't think that hard about it.
Yeah, well, I've been writing about nature and the human relationship to nature for a long time. And along the way, I had occasion to visit both a feedlot and a potato farm in Idaho. And what I saw there in both cases, and it was in the span of a few months, kind of shocked me and made me realize I had no idea how our food was grown and that it raised all sorts of really troubling issues. The feedlot was the one on I-5 right here in California. I was driving to driving south on I-5 to an interview, and suddenly this incredible stench assailed me on the highway. But I couldn't see. Everything looked fine as you walked around. It was your golden California hills. And then, after a couple miles of the stench, I hit the feedlot, and I saw this stunning black landscape, black soil, which actually was manure, black cows, and a mountain, two mountains, one of corn and one of manure. And I had no idea this is how we were growing beef in this country. And then the other example was being on a very automated, huge potato farm in Idaho, where one farmer was farming 10 or 15,000 acres, all automatic, shooting fertilizer and poisons out of an irrigation pivot, and eating potatoes.
The fact that we get our food today from a big, sprawling, global, automated food industry that shocked you, and I guess that's just something new. That's not the way it was done for thousands of years before. Can you give us a quick overview of how things are different with respect to food and why this may not be a good thing?
Well, yeah. I mean, the big change happens after World War II, and that's how we learned how to grow huge amounts of food with very, very few people. Now one American can feed 136 of us. What that means in practice is that none of us have been on a farm, and we don't know farmers. So the reason I could be shocked by what I saw in the industrial food system is that the food chain has gotten very long, very opaque, and we are all, you know, at the far end of a system that has very, murky beginnings.
Well, Michael, let me ask you about this, though. You say, it sounds like this is driven by the economies of scale. You said one farmer can feed, I thought it was 139 or 129 Americans?
136 people. Yeah.
That's a lot. That's a vast economy of scale. But it sounds like it's partly a good thing economically and partly a bad thing. I mean, is that how you think about it? Is there a good thing about this at all?
Yeah, there are some good things about it. But I would say the bad outweigh the good. The only way you can do this and achieve these economies of scale is by using lots of fossil fuel in place of sunlight in growing your food. It's chemicals that allow you to save all that labor, chemical pesticides, chemical fertilizers, and machinery. The good thing is, and it is arguably a good thing, is that in America today, a person can go into a fast food outlet and have a bacon double cheeseburger.
That's a good thing.
And French fries and a large Coke for less than what he would earn at minimum wage in an hour. Now, in the long sweep of history, that's an astoundingly good thing.
Right.
That so many people could have so much food by working, mere minutes. So food is a very small part of our expenditures. And from certain perspectives, it is a good thing. And certainly from a political perspective, governments love cheap food. They sleep better.
Well, if you're a poor person, Michael, it's not just governments that love cheap food. If you have a subsistence wage anywhere in the world, isn't cheap food like a great boon to you?
The problem is that cheap food is not as cheap as it appears, or is not as cheap. You know, at the register it's very cheap, but it also takes a great deal of fossil fuel to produce, a great deal of subsidies to produce, and has an enormous cost to the environment, not to mention the other species involved in the food system, not to mention the workers in the food system. So, what we've succeeded in doing is making it very cheap at the register by externalizing the real costs of producing this food this way.
Right. I was going to use that word. There are in our food consumption and production a great deal of what economists call externalities, right? Costs not paid by the parties to the transaction. They're put on the rest of us, or they're put on the environment and all that, right?
Yeah, and the great example, of course, is feedlot animal protein, milk and meat produced on feedlots. The only reason that it is economical to crowd animals into these vast animal cities. I mean, just put aside their misery, is the fact that, one, the government underwrites this by not regulating these places the way they would regulate a real city that produced a comparable amount of waste, or a real factory that produced a comparable amount of pollution. So they get a kind of free pass from a regulatory point of view. Plus, the government allows them to use antibiotics in the feed, which has an enormous cost, which is to say the rise of antibiotic-resistant microbes. So that's two factors that support that system and that are not counted in the price. And the third, of course, is subsidized grain, the fact that feedlots can buy grain cheaper than it costs farmers to grow it. And the only reason they can do that is the government is writing a check to the farmers for every bushel of corn or soy that they grow. So that's another cost that we're all paying as taxpayers to the tune of, corn subsidies alone are $4 or $5 billion a year.
California, aren't water subsidies another
exactly
one of
these,
costs?
California farmers pride themselves on not receiving government subsidies, but in fact they overlook, like most Westerners always have, the benefit of federal water programs.
So, is there any hope of making the system so that we still have inexpensive food, but that it's truly inexpensive and doesn't depend so much on chemical fuels, or if we give up the petroleum-based and subsidy-based nature of agriculture, do we have to go to back to backyard farming and never having out-of-season fruits and things like that?
Well, I don't think no one's talking about going back, and I think it's a myth about sustainable agriculture that it's turning back the scales. I see it as really a post-industrial agriculture. It uses some of the wisdom of traditional agriculture, which we're learning. Had a lot more to teach us than we recognized during the 20th century. Will food be this cheap again? I mean, no. I think the era of cheap food, just like the era of cheap oil, is over. I think we will have to get used to the idea that spending 9% of your income on food, which we've been doing in America, was an anomaly, an historical anomaly underwritten by cheap fossil fuel. And we will all be spending more for food. This is going to be an enormous problem for people who don't have more disposable income. But I think it will involve really a shift in our priorities.
You know, and, Michael, speaking of the big organic food and all that, in your book, The Omnivore's Dilemma, you say, you know, we think we're going back to nature and all that, and there's some truth to that. But the cost of producing this stuff, especially transporting it once it's produced, is still very, very high, right?
Yeah, I mean, the amount of oil we use to move food around is just absurd. I mean, we're catching salmon sustainably in Alaska, shipping it to China to be filleted, and then bringing it back to the West Coast to be eaten.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. Our subject today is the morality of food. Our guest is Michael Pollan, author of The Omnivore's Dilemma and In Defense of Food. Is food merely a matter of eating? This is Philosophy Talk, and we're discussing the morality of food. Our guest is Michael Pollan, author of The Omnivore's Dilemma, and also most recently, In Defense of Food. I'm Ken Taylor.
And I'm John Perry. Michael, I want your help in forming a personal food philosophy. Now, my vegan friends typically are very concerned about the ethics of eating, which is fine, but I'm not sure they really enjoy food. My gourmet friends love their food and wine, but they really don't want to get involved in thinking about factory farms and goose torture involved in tasty pâtés. Now, you seem, just judging from your books, to enjoy eating and yet be very alive to the ethical issues. What are the guidelines? What's your point of view? How can you help us achieve this kind of resolution of issues that you seem to have done?
Well, I don't think that conflict is quite the way you frame it. I mean, I know lots of gourmets who actually do think a lot about where their food comes from and that their pleasure in eating is inflected by the knowledge of where their food comes from, for better or worse. And that, you know, food is not just chemicals on our tongue. It really is the story. And when you learn that this was a wild-caught salmon from Alaska, not a farm salmon from Chile, it really does taste better. So I think that that there is not a contradiction between pleasure and responsibility in eating today, just because we have these options. The contradiction is between pleasurable, responsible eating and money, the fact that it costs more to eat this way.
Do you eat ethically? Do you enjoy your food? Are you a nutrition nut? Share your perspective on food and its philosophical implications.
The number is 415-841-4134, 415-841-4134. And you can email us at comments@philosophytalk.org.
Michael, I want to ask you about a definitional question. You say, in defense of food. Now, that's an odd thing for a book to be about, in defense of food. How could you have to defend food? But I take it you have a certain understanding of food, the concept food. What is food, in your view?
Well, you know, food needs to be defended because it's under attack from two quarters. I mean, one is from the industry, which has bent on taking perfectly good foods and complicating them beyond recognition to make more money from them. I mean, the stores now are full of things that I don't think we should call food, that are edible food-like products.
Edible food-like products. That sounds ugly.
When you see something like, you know, no-fat sour cream or something like that, look at the ingredients and you will find that there's no cream in it. So that there is a whole lot of simulation going on in food that I think is not very helpful in terms of our health. And so what I'm suggesting is getting back to a more traditional definition of food where you're not allowed to use words like sour cream if you don't actually have sour cream in your product is a good thing.
So you're talking about
truth and
advertising?
You need to attach words to things. Yeah, it's
truth and advertising? I mean, is food something that comes from nature only? Is any synthetic thing food?
Is any synthetic thing food? Well,
I don't know. That's a good question. In general, food is the collection of plants, animals, and fungi that we've been eating for a long time. There are some new things that we have invented, and there are novelties that are, you know, I suppose are okay. But in general, I think we're better off with foods that have been around for a while. That I really do believe that you know, culture has a certain Darwinian process of sorting out the good from the bad, the things that are healthy from the things that turn out not to be healthy. And a lot of the innovations we've come up with have turned out not to be so healthy, margarine being a great example.
Right. It was supposed to be the great
butter.
Right. You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're talking about the morality of food. You can join our conversation. 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. And we have a caller on the line now, Dave in San Francisco.
Good morning, gentlemen.
Welcome, Dave.
I have a question about trying. I'm in agreement with Mr. Pollan about his conclusions about food production and consumption, but I have a concern that if we try to be cleaner and greener and use less petroleum, that we're likely to end up with less food, and less food is going to bear very hard on people who barely can afford it now. And I don't mean mostly Americans; I mean worldwide. And if we have to cut population by 25% to get by on the amount of food we can effectively raise, who's going to deal with the politics of that?
Well, that's a very good question, Dave. Michael, what do you think?
Well, it is the big question. Can we feed the world sustainably? Or can the world feed itself sustainably? The honest answer is I don't know for sure, but I can tell you we're not feeding the world the way we're doing it today with lots of fossil fuel and oil. We still have over a billion hungry people on this planet, even though there is plenty of food. There's 3,000 calories for every human being. Why is that? Well, access to food is as important as yield. The other thing to consider is that when we talk about agricultural yields, we're really talking about commodities, not food. We're talking about corn and soy, which are really industrial raw materials that people don't eat as food. Half of the food we're growing, we're feeding to animals.
Right, and so, we're feeding to animals. That's your book, The Omnivore's Dilemma, is an eye-opener. We're feeding this corn to animals that aren't evolved to eat it, and it makes them sick, and then we have to feed chemicals to heal
to
them.
To keep
from
them healthy. So, you know, simply by rational, and then the other thing is we're feeding, I don't know exactly what the figures, but we're feeding another 5 or 10% of this so-called food to our cars in the form of biofuels, ethanol. So there's a lot of slack in the system, and we shouldn't overlook that, and we shouldn't be stampeded by companies like Monsanto telling us we have to double agricultural yield over the next 30 years to feed a hungry population. This may not be true.
But, Michael, but I do think there's a part of Dave's question you haven't addressed. You've sort of tiptoed up to it. You said there's lots of food, and some of it isn't really food, but there's lots of food. There's enough food to go around, so there's a bad distribution system.
Well, that's right. That's right.
So that's one thing to attack the distribution system. It's another thing to attack food itself. I mean, you really want to reform our attitudes toward food itself as well as this distribution thing. Am I right about that?
Yeah. Well, you know, I think we have to look at issues like land reform interesting rotations as important technological breakthroughs, potentially, as genetically modified seeds or other tricks to boost production. What I'm arguing for is not one particular way to eat. I think people need to resolve that for themselves. What I'm arguing for is being more conscious about our eating. I think when people simply perform the mental exercise of thinking about where their food comes from, how do they feel about eating from such a food chain, they will make better decisions without being told by me what decisions to make. I think the biggest problem in our food system is that we are ignorant of where our food comes from, and therefore oblivious to the ethical, moral, environmental implications of our food choices. So, it's probably a poignant old journalist's faith that knowledge will produce better behavior. But my sense is, and what I've observed is, that that is true.
Well, one thing about being ignorant about where food comes from is a lot of people don't realize how simple it is to have food. I mean, it's not that hard to raise chickens. The only problem with raising chickens is it's usually illegal within any kind of city. And they eat bugs for the most part. You don't need to give them that much food. And it's not hard to grow vegetables. So wouldn't a lot of the distribution problem be solved if we just encourage people to go back to doing the simple things that they described in the Roving Philosophical Reporter and get as much of their food they can from chickens and vegetables they can raise in their own backyard.
Well, look, I think in this country we have this tremendous resource, which is called the front lawn and the back lawns of America, 25,000 square miles, I think, some ridiculous figure, that is all, collecting solar energy and wasting it. And if we could harness this, if we could rip out these lawns and start growing some food in our cities, in our suburbs, that would make a tremendous contribution. During the Victory Garden movement and during World War II, 40% of America's produce was grown in Victory Gardens. And so I think, I don't think that that's a trivial solution. I think there is a lot of food we could all be growing. It would be the cheapest, most local, most fresh and nutritious food you could possibly have.
We'd love to know what you think. We're talking about the morality of food. 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. Or email us at comments@philosophytalk.org. Janet in Berkeley's on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Janet.
Good morning. I'm calling to address the conundrum of eating to live or living to eat. And one resolution of this seeming opposition is the Chinese approach to food, which states that if you don't enjoy what you're eating, you won't get all the benefit from it that you might.
Okay, Janet.
I think that that's true. I mean, I think that pleasure in eating, we have science that suggests that your ability to extract nutrients from your food depends on your mindset when you sit down to eat. And if you're happier and looking forward to what you're eating, you will produce more enzymes that will allow you to more efficiently digest it.
But Michael, human culture has played a trick on evolution. We like the sweet stuff because the sweet stuff in nature is bound up with these complex fibers and stuff that, don't taste all that great but are good for our systems. But now we've learned how to separate the sweet stuff from the fiber. We enjoy the sweet stuff tremendously, right? But the taking pleasure in the sweet stuff won't do you any good if you extract it away from its natural setting.
Well, I think that there are different kinds of pleasures. I think there are simple pleasures of fast food. I mean, look, there are pleasures to fast food. There are pleasures to those hits of sugar and salt and fat. But they are fleeting pleasures, and there are deeper pleasures that are founded on a fuller knowledge of what you're eating and a greater complexity. There's pleasure and there's pleasure.
So we've got another caller in the line. That's Philip in San Francisco. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Philip.
Hi, thank you. Two questions. One was, do you guys think that we as a culture in the United States are really so, like, distance from our food, that in the sense that, I mean, if we had to, I think people should mandatorily basically have to, if you eat cow, you should have to slaughter a cow. You should have to spend time on a farm or wherever and slaughter a cow or slaughter pigs. Like, would that bring us closer to our food mandatorily if people have to do that? And the second thing is, have you guys all seen Soylent Green? And do you think of it as prophecy in some sense, like prophetic, or just 70s kitsch science fiction? That's it.
Michael, take those questions in whatever order you want.
Well, let me combine them. I think everyone should have to slaughter some tofu before they eat it. No, I think, I did go through this process of slaughtering some chickens and hunting a boar when I was writing Omnivore's Dilemma, because I did feel it was important to reconnect with what was at stake. And whether I'm,
so to speak, steak.
Yeah. Whether I'm prepared to ask this of everybody else or not, I don't know. But I think it. I recommend it. And I think if you can't get your head around doing that, you should rethink your freedom eating meat. In terms of Soylent Green, there is I haven't seen the movie, but I kind of know the premise. There is a move in the industry to essentially replace food with edible food-like substances. And now you're hearing a lot about in vitro meat. The idea that, and many animal rightists are very comfortable with this notion that you would simply clone muscle cells of chicken or beef or whatever and grow it in a petri dish or on some kind of substrate in a laboratory, and that would relieve you of having to kill animals. It makes a certain kind of logic. I'm not that interested in eating that stuff, however. But some people are. So I think that's an interesting moral question. I mean, if you are a vegan or vegetarian and you are offered this cloned meat-like substance, does that solve your problem with eating meat?
John, you got a comment over there, right?
Yeah, I mean, just you could imagine someday we'll just have this big, you know, half mile long chicken breast in Kansas that gets harvested with not attached to any brain, so they just take it off, package it, and let it grow back without hurting anything. I mean, in a way, that does make sense, but from some point of view, I'm not convinced that the old system where people raised chickens and they had for a chicken, pretty decent life, you know, what do we now call free-range chickens, and then butchered them in the way you do on a farm, which is, you know, pretty quick, was such a bad system. And I think I would prefer that just having no chickens and a big chicken breast in Kansas. I think it'd be better for chickens, too. On the other hand, what I think people should be exposed to is not field dressing a moose. We've got a president, or we may soon have a president who can show them how to do that.
A vice president.
But they ought to see what actually happens in the stockyards in Omaha or wherever where cows are killed today. And they ought to say, gee, that's not the way to do it. Maybe to raise meat and kill them, but we shouldn't do it that way.
I think one of the thought experiments that I suggest in Omnivore's Dilemma is, what if the walls of all the slaughterhouses, what if we required them to be glass? You know, we don't have to regulate this. Let's just, you know, shed a little light on it. I think that would very quickly change people's meat-eating habits and the way that corporations go about processing meat. So I think transparency could do a lot for making people sort of face up to the issues. And also, you know, these abuses take place because they're hidden from view. And they are, make no mistake, there is horrible treatment of animals. But as you suggest, John, we have to understand, if we started eating from that giant breast, chicken breast in Kansas, there would be no chickens left.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're shining a light on the morality of food with the author of the best-selling book, The Omnivore's Dilemma, and most recently, In Defense of Food. That's Michael Pollan.
We're going to delve into some of the practical implications we omnivores face. We'll start with political questions. The yearly farm bill passed by Congress has a huge influence on how we eat, not only in America, but around the world. What are the effects of the farm bill, and what should farmers and Congress be doing instead?
We'll get to more calls and emails when Philosophy Talk continues.
With a leak.
Is the food we eat mostly a creation of the food industry? An assembly of chemicals and nutrients that defies description as actual food? I'm Ken Taylor, and this is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm John Perry, and we're discussing the morality of food with Michael Pollan, author of The Omnivore's Dilemma and In Defense of Food. We've got email here from Fred. Fred says, you say that we currently waste a lot of money transporting food using fossil fuels. If we could transport food using renewable forms of energy, what would that do to food prices?
Well, it's only, you know, the way that fossil fuel ends up in your food is there are several ways. It's not just moving it around. And I think, yeah, using renewable fuels to move food around would be a good idea, unless those fuels, of course, were ethanol, which doesn't really solve the problem because it basically takes as much fossil fuel to make ethanol as you replace with using it. But fossil fuel gets into your food through the fertilizer, which is made from natural gas, through the pesticides, which are made from petroleum, through the use of diesel equipment on the farm, and then the processing. That adds about 9 calories of fossil fuel energy to every calorie of food. When you take, say, a simple grain and turn it into breakfast cereal, very energy-intensive process. So there's a lot more involved than just what we're gonna put in the truck gas tanks.
So it's a big, complicated equation. I mean, and you really think... So we're stuck with fossil fuels. You really think, would this problem, all the environmental degradation and the ethical implications, really just go away if we grew our food locally and ate locally, like in our Roving Philosophical Report?
No, I mean, I think it would help. I mean, I think in a way the solution is big and very simple, and that is essentially to take this fossil fuel-based system and put it back on a basis of contemporary sunlight. You know, the great thing about food and the reason it can be re-solarized more easily than other parts of the food economy is that every calorie you have ever eaten is the result of photosynthesis. We have this free lunch, and that is sunlight hitting leaves and chloroplasts, taking water and carbon dioxide and turning it into food and oxygen. It's an amazing system, and it still works. We just, for some reason, decided that it wasn't quite efficient enough for our purposes.
Well, but here's a question for you. We decided. Was it free market capitalism that decided? Was it the government that decided? I mean, there's a farm bill that I know kind of warps the market. But what made this happen? You know, local decisions happening locally or some top-down bureaucrat or what?
There were policies for most of the 20th century that were designed around increasing the output of certain commodity crops using fossil fuels to do it. I mean, the government really pushed us in this direction. They encouraged the conversion of the munitions industry after World War II to make fertilizers. It's the same thing. Ammonium nitrate is in bombs and it's in fertilizers. They encouraged the conversion of nerve gas research into pesticides. So they were definitely pushing us in this direction. And they were doing it for a good reason, from their view, which was to essentially make farming more efficient and allow us to drive people off the land and into the cities where, of course, during industrialization, we had a great need for labor. So one of the things we wanted to do, and there's a whole history of government efforts to essentially shrink the number of farmers in this country for political as well as economic reasons, has been to make each farmer more efficient so you could take this whole pool of labor, and you would always take the best students in rural areas and you send them off to college and then to the cities, and leave people on the farms who, you know, still love to farm, maybe weren't the brightest bulbs, and then you would basically help them out by giving them these high-tech solutions
in a
bottle.
We've got lots of callers on the line. 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. And Charles in Richmond's on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Charles.
Hi, yes. I just want to say that I used to live in I'm an East Bay grown and raised boy, whatever, but I used to live in Los Angeles, so I went up and down Highway 5 quite a bit, and there is some transparency, which I guess is absolutely correct. If you saw a sausage being made, would you eat it sort of thing? But you go down by Harris Ranch, and there's a big feedlot there, right off to the left if you're going south. And when I would go south, a very nice restaurant just past that, I had no appetite after smelling it. Coming north, I would stop and have a nice steak or whatever, and you know. But transparency is absolutely what's needed in sausage and in financial systems. Thank you.
Michael, you got a comment? Thanks for the call.
You know, I agree. And, it's always struck me that Harris Ranch is the feedlot I was describing earlier as kind of starting my interest in the subject. But it is kind of amazing that there is a little steakhouse in the midst of that. And the idea that you could look at that feedlot, smell that stench, and then say, hey, a nice ribeye is just what the doctor ordered. But I think that's true. I think in one direction, you don't get the smell before you get to the steakhouse.
The next step
is to make that the slaughterhouse there more transparent, as well as the way they're feeding the animals.
John, you got to come.
Yeah, with respect to feedlots, I don't want to defend feedlots, but there is this empirical question. They're clearly offensive to the people on Highway 5, and we look at them and we think that the cattle must really hate them. I think there is some research. Now, it may have been supported by the National Hereford Council or something.
No doubt.
That suggests that cattle actually don't mind feedlots so much. However, when it gets to the way they slaughter them, that's a different story.
Well, yeah, cattle, their consciousness is probably kind of simple. But
Can I address that question?
I want to take it in a slightly different direction in the short time we have left. Because what does this... I'm thinking about our relationship to nature and what John Stuart Mill derisively called the wisdom of nature, because he thought no nature. It seems like we're trying to improve upon nature through, you know, the scientific production of food and all that stuff. Are we wise enough actually to improve upon nature, or should we learn to listen to nature? You know, all this nutrition stuff often gets it wrong. It becomes gospel for a day, and then boom, it's wrong.
Well, I think we overestimate our knowledge of these systems. We overestimate our knowledge of what is going on in food, what is going on in human digestion. I think we do need to be a little bit humbler about that. There's nothing wrong with improving upon nature. People have been doing that for a long time. They've done it successfully and disastrously. And it argues for, you know, looking at models that have worked in the past. It argues for using ecology as your model when you're designing a food system rather than the model of the factory, which is essentially what we've done. Applying that model to nature has proven to be a disaster. But there are ecological models of growing food that do represent improvements on nature that leave the animals much happier and are highly productive. So it really is just kind of what mental construct we take when we are improving nature.
Right.
There are good and bad ways to do that.
I understand that. But you rail in your books against reductionist nutrition science. So you're not, at least the way the science has gone, you're not really a fan of that science. But
no, I think that they have taught us very, very little. And all the public health advice we've gotten about food for most of the 20th century has actually turned out to be not very good advice. I mean, the whole low-fat public health campaign has, coincided with the rise of obesity and turns out to have been based on a really poor understanding of both fats and carbohydrates in the diet. I think that the move to get everybody off of animal fats and onto vegetable fats in the form of margarine, which became sources of trans fats in the diet, was a public health disaster. So I think that the science of nutrition is, to put it charitably, young. It's kind of where surgery was in the year 1650. It has some promise, but I'm not ready to get up on the table.
Michael, on that kind of sobering note, I'm going to have to thank you for joining us. It's really been a pleasure.
Thank you very much.
Our guest has been Michael Pollan, professor of journalism at the University of California, Berkeley, author of The Omnivore's Dilemma, and also In Defense of Food. So, John, you old foodie, what did you learn about food today?
Well, I learned what I suspected, that when you get into this topic, it's fraught with difficulties that will threaten to change your habits. But I guess that's okay. That's why we do philosophy, so we can learn more about the world. But it is puzzling exactly what we should do. And so I like most of our programs, I've just learned to be more puzzled.
I wish we had time to talk more about food science. So Michael has some really enlightening things to say about the state of food science, and it does make you think we don't really know anything. And I do think one message is maybe we should have less epistemic hubris, more epistemic humility about what we know and what we think we know. But, there's lots of more ground we could cover. This conversation continues, as always, on our blog, theblog.philosophytalk.org, where our motto is Cogito Ergo Blogo, I think, therefore I blog.
And you can download podcasts of our program from our website as well.